You are listening to Iran Radio, and we are so glad to have you on this part of our schedule. And here are some interesting facts about Islam. Let's listen. Islam is the world's second largest religion, and it is a monotheistic faith with about 1.8 billion followers worldwide, originating in Mecca during the life of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of Allah upon him and his progeny. Islam means submission to the will of Allah, and its followers are called Muslims. Muslims believe in one God, Allah, who is the creator of all things and has no partners or equals. The Quran is the holy book of Islam, believed to be the literal word of Allah revealed to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of Allah upon him and his progeny. Muslims adhere to the five pillars of Islam: Shahada, or declaration of faith; Salah, or prayer; Zakat, or charity; Saum, or fasting during Ramadan; and Hajj, or pilgrimage to Mecca. The Islamic year is 11 days shorter than the year used in the Western world. This is because the Western year is based on the orbit of the Earth around the Sun instead of on the phases of the Moon. And we'll listen to continuation of Iran Radio. We start off this hour with the Spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. After that, we have For Humanity, a variety of subjects from the Holy Quran, which predominantly tend to be social issues, are dealt with in this program. And we finish off this hour's program with our radio productions feature. Stay with us for the next hour.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Evening. The Lebanon-Israel escalation cannot be understood without confronting the scale of the Israeli violations of the ceasefire. Reports indicate that Israeli forces have carried out over 10,000 documented air and land violations, eroding trust in international guarantees and raising urgent questions about accountability. Against this backdrop, the logic of Hezbollah's disarmament appears increasingly untenable when violations continue unchecked, as disarmament would leave Lebanon exposed to repeated incursions and attacks. The situation grew even more volatile yesterday when Israel struck Beirut and killed Hezbollah's chief of staff, Haytham Ali Tabatabai, a figure considered second only to the group's secretary general. I am Bahman Roy, and in this spotlight, we will examine whether Israeli violations represent a breakdown of international commitments, how they shape the security calculus of Lebanese actors, and whether guarantors of the ceasefire can still be trusted to enforce peace. Let us begin with a report.
A mass funeral was held on Monday in Beirut's southern suburbs for Hezbollah commander Haytham al-Tabatabai and two of his companions who were killed in an Israeli airstrike a day earlier. Head of Hezbollah Executive Council Sheikh Ali Damush addressed the crowd, praising al-Tabatabai for his great contributions to Hezbollah's achievements. Sheikh Damush said Hezbollah will become stronger with the assassination of its leaders, stressing that Israel will not achieve its goals.
It is the state's duty to protect its citizens and sovereignty. The Lebanese government needs to develop plans for how it will restore the country's sovereignty. All the concessions made so far by the government on the monopoly of arms and accepting U.S. proposals have produced no tangible results. Today, the Israeli enemy is violating all of Lebanon in an attempt to force us to surrender, but we will never give in.
Observers say the concessions made by the Lebanese government have emboldened Israel to disregard the ceasefire agreement that came into force a year ago.
This is Zionist aggression blessed and supported by the U.S., specifically President Trump. This aggression is the responsibility of the Lebanese government, and of all those counting on some form of U.S. mediation to secure an Israeli withdrawal from southern Lebanon. This enemy will not withdraw through diplomacy or negotiations. The only strategic option we have is to reestablish the golden equation, a strategy of national security which includes the people, the army, and the resistance.
The crowds attending the funeral in Beirut emphasize that they will continue to support Hezbollah.
Eventually, we will retaliate, and we will never back down. Young or old, it makes no difference to us, since we will remain on this path, and we are all ready to sacrifice our lives. No matter how many people Israel kills and how many houses it destroys, we will always support the resistance movement.
We are here to give our condolences to the family of the martyrs who have given us dignity. They have sacrificed their lives to protect us, and we also are ready to be martyrs like them.
Hezbollah said that Tabatabai played a major role in Lebanon's liberation from Israeli occupation in the year 2000, as well as in fighting Takfiri militants in Syria and Lebanon. That made him a primary target for Israel and the United States.
Haytham Tabatabai was one of the few young men who founded the grassroots movement, later known as Hezbollah. Today, he is remembered as a military commander of the resistance movement, who played an outstanding role in operations against Israeli and Takfiri terrorism for some three decades. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Ali Rezk, security and political analyst, joining us from Beirut. And Batul Sobeiti, activist and political analyst, joining us from London. Very good to have you on the programme. I'm going to start the conversation with Ali. I'm going to start with the assassination of Hezbollah's chief of staff yesterday. What do you think is going to be the direct consequences of that? Is it going to instill a new level of fear within the organisation, or is it going to, and their supporters, or do you believe that it is going to actually strengthen the resolve for retaliation?
I think that this is not going to lead to a major escalation on Hezbollah's part, at least not in the foreseeable future. I think that Hezbollah's intent not to give Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu what he wants, Benjamin Netanyahu, domestically speaking, the domestic Israeli political level, I think he's looking for another war after the end of the war on Gaza. Before that, you had also the end of the war in Lebanon. I'm talking, of course, theoretically, both in Gaza and Lebanon, the bombings continue, but it's not the full-scale war which we had witnessed before. So I think that, again, Hezbollah is not going to issue a kind of action or go ahead with a kind of action that would lead to all-out war. I think the Israelis, quite likely, they are going to try and continue with assassination attempts. And this, by the way, was anticipated. I think that many people were expecting that Israel was going to escalate. The big question was how. Will it resort to full-scale warfare? Will it resort to assassinations? Now it appears to be in the assassination phase. And again, I think that this kind of security intelligence war, what I mean by that, assassination operations, I think this is going to continue, especially that Israel believes it enjoys the advantage. Now, quickly regarding what you mentioned in your question about how this will impact Hezbollah, I think you were talking about the popularity or the resolve. I think it's safe to say that Hezbollah's resolve will only increase. The fact that it, or the commitment not to disarm, will also increase, its determination will increase, and I think that the Lebanese state is the one in the most difficult position with these kinds of Israeli operations, because the Lebanese state has been saying, you want us to plan to disarm Hezbollah, but you keep attacking Hezbollah, and so this places the state in a very difficult corner.
Right, very good. We're going to talk about the reactions of the Lebanese state about this. But let me continue with another question regarding this latest act of terrorism by Israel. Batul, do you believe that the martyrdom of Haytham is going to weaken as well as military command? And what makes the Israelis believe that it might have such effect, given the successful structure of Hezbollah in kind of resilience and succession planning usually?
Thank you, and you again. I'd sort of which leaders are.
Well, I believe the connection with Batul might need to be restored because I cannot hear you. Can you try again answering the question? Because I could not hear you at all. All right, Ali, would you please continue with answering the question?
I think you have to look at what the objectives were. Was the Israeli objective to weaken Hezbollah, to weaken its morale? Was it something else? Was it about Netanyahu's own domestic political calculations? Because Netanyahu has been promoting this. The Israelis have been highlighting that this is the number two in Hezbollah. So it's as if they're trying to promote such a dramatic achievement being made. So that's, you have to bear in mind that that's one of the Israeli aims, meaning that Netanyahu can use this domestically at an Israeli domestic political level. As you said, the Israelis have assassinated leader after leader of Hezbollah, Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi, Sheikh Raghib Harab, in addition to Haj Imad Mughniyeh. Of course, the most recent and the biggest loss was Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, which was about 1 year ago. Basically, the Israelis think that they can achieve, or this is the what Israelis are good at. When it comes to ground infantry fighting, I think that the Israelis have been dealt severe blows before. But in terms of this kind of warfare, the security intelligence warfare, we have to admit that they do enjoy an upper hand, and that's why they're resorting to these kinds of methods. Now, how successful are they going to be? That's a different story. If you look at the history of assassinations, the history of assassinations hasn't done much in terms of weakening Hezbollah. Now, after the assassination of Sayyid Hassan, has this weakened movement or not? It's too early to tell, but I will say this. I think that due to the special status which Sayyid Hassan enjoyed, I think that even those people who weren't with Hezbollah but were supportive or sympathetic to the movement are now going to flock to its ranks merely out of that passion for Sayyid Hassan. So I think that in the longer term, this step taken by Israel may indeed backfire in terms of how it will influence or impact Hezbollah.
Right, Batul, I'm glad that you're back, hopefully. So regardless of the objective of the Israelis, what do you think will be the reaction of Hezbollah? Do you believe it's going to be immediate retaliation? As we know that the Israeli air defense is on high alert right now, what do you think it is going to be, more of a reserved manner?
Yes, the Islamic Resistance of Lebanon is adhering to the decision to remove the weapons south of the Lifani River out of commitment to the state and what was agreed on November the 27th, not because it believes that the other side is right. Since the other side has not adhered to this ceasefire agreement at all, the resistance has the unreserved right not to adhere to it either. The agreement is considered void because the other side has not respected it. So here is where the equation emerges. If the erosion inflicted by Israel to the resistance is less than the rate of the resistance's growth and restoration of its capabilities, then I believe that strategic patience ensures a general policy of continued growth despite the enemy's expansionist ambitions. When it becomes completely clear that this enemy does not restrain itself and continues all forms of violation, then responding becomes necessary because it commits these violations even without being responded to, justifying them with various excuses such as, you know, claiming that the resistance is growing. But if the pace of the strikes against the resistance increases to the point where the losses and the erosion exceed the growth and the recuperation, then I believe that's where we might see the equation change and the resistance may decide to respond in whatever manner it deems appropriate. And at that point, we could expect a more open war. The resistance, of course, has never initiated a war. Its actions have always been a response to wars imposed on it. These are defensive wars, and of course, defensive wars, it goes without saying, are fully justified. Sometimes when the enemy's strikes cause damage and destruction, the resistance may choose to delay, postpone, or withdraw, it must be said that this is not out of weakness, but in preparation for a phase in which it can establish a deterrent equation within what it calls strategic balance. So I want to emphasize that the matter is not the resistance retaliating for each attack, because we are currently at one stop and one pit in a long battle that is not linked to any individual. And just on the question that you asked me previously that I couldn't respond to, I would say that the battle in which the leaders are killed fighting is a successful one, because the morale and the spirit that this gives the resistance fighters on the ground multiplies, and for the surrounding support of the resistance,
right.
The resistance believes that sacrifices are the required price. That's how they know that liberation is on its way, as long as blood is being given. And the resistance has proven again and again that the killing of its leaders strengthens their movement. And never at any point in time was the resistance able to recruit the number of fighters and supporters that it is able to, as it has now. Whether in Lebanon or in Gaza, many more times than it was able to previously. And this is due to the exposure and the unveiling of the enemy to such an extent that the resistance is no longer now a luxury option, but rather an obligatory choice for those who did not previously believe in this.
Right, Ali, I want to talk about the mechanisms of this ceasefire, the so-called ceasefire. Of course, I'm not sure if we can call it a ceasefire when more than 10,000 violations have occurred. Tell me about what do you think these so many ceasefire violations tell about the credibility of the guarantors of this ceasefire?
Well, look, everybody knows that the United States is not a neutral mediator, that it sides with the Israelis. And you've heard what the American envoys have said. Clearly, they're saying that Israel has a right to defend itself. It decides when to attack. Even regarding this assassination of Haytham Tabtabai, they said that Israel behaves as a sovereign nation, and it decides how to defend its own security. So it's no secret that the United States sides with the Israelis, even often at the expense of American interests, in my humble opinion. But I think that ultimately what the Israeli goal is to have something which is similar to Syria take place in Lebanon. I am sure you saw the tour which Benjamin Netanyahu made to southern Syria, where he was accompanied by a number of Israeli senior officials. And they've been violating Syrian territory. They want to expand. In fact, they are expanding into Syria. And they want something similar to play out in Lebanon. Now, what prevents them from pursuing something similar in Lebanon is Hezbollah, despite the fact that it was dealt some very, very heavy, unprecedented blows. Hezbollah remains a force to be reckoned with, particularly if the opposing side wants to occupy territory. So that's the Israeli goal, to try and overcome or to remove this Hezbollah obstacle, which poses an obstacle to further expansion, which is part of the Zionist ideology of the Greater Israel, which includes Syria, other places. Now, the issue which is somewhat not very surprising, but I think not consistent with American interests, is that the Americans are allowing them to do this. And again, I'm not sure that this serves American interests. When America wants to establish itself as an influential player, it has an ally in Lebanese President Joseph Aoun, and these Israeli actions all undermine this. I don't think that it's in U.S. interest to have failed states in Syria and in Lebanon. It's in Israeli interests, and the Americans appear in one or another to be following the Israeli truck, or to be following the Israeli line, so to speak.
Right, Bethel, I want to talk about the effects of these violations on Lebanese civilians and the population, general population in Lebanon. Do you believe these violations have changed their perception of security?
Yes, the resistance wants to cultivate a general consensus amongst Lebanese nationals that the issue is with the occupation and not the resistance weapons. These weapons are what deters the entity from occupying Lebanon entirely. And when this belief becomes cemented, then you'll get Lebanese society calling for increased protection of the resistance as this essential credit in liberation. Of course, it needs to be said that Lebanon is a special case compared to other resistance fronts, in that each front has its own conditions, circumstances, and methods of resistance. In Lebanon, the resistance represents a portion of the population, and many parties are not a part of the resistance. You have a large segment in Lebanon that does not believe in the resistance option or even conspires against it. The resistance takes this into account and seeks to maintain a degree of majority support, since achieving consensus in this domain is very difficult. But when the needs of the resistance becomes a national necessity because of the enemy's violations, the internal atmosphere becomes ideal for coordinating resistance action and creating deterrence, meaning forming a comprehensive national deterrent balance. Until now, there are still voices within Lebanon, mostly from the Christian parties, you could say, calling for the disarmament of the resistance. But when popular demands shift and express themselves in the streets, calling for the necessity of responding, then the response becomes a popular demand rather than a unilateral decision by one party dragging the country into war, which is what the resistance aims to avoid.
Right, one final question for Ali before continuing the conversation with Batul. Ali, do you think that the issue of disarmament, of course, how do you think this is going to change dynamics regarding the pressure from the Lebanese government on the issue of disarmament by Hezbollah?
I think that obviously this is going to make Hezbollah more committed to preserving its arms. Remember that Hezbollah also has a large segment of supporters in Lebanon, and these supporters, even if we were to assume that Hezbollah was ready to make concessions in terms of its weapons, its supporters wouldn't accept that. So I think that it's safe to say that this issue has been shelved. Now, the Lebanese government, the Lebanese state, how it's going to behave, I think that you have a split in the Lebanese, amongst the Lebanese state officials. The Lebanese Prime Minister, Nawab Salam, he's enthusiastic for disarmament. The Lebanese President, Joseph Aoun, has called for a more calculated approach, one which focuses on dialogue. Again, as I said in my earlier answer, the Lebanese state is the one which is in a most difficult situation right now as a result of the Israeli actions. I think that it depends on how much the Lebanese state bows down to American pressures, or, on the other hand, how it takes a firm stance. Up until now, the Lebanese army in particular has been very committed not to enter into a kind of confrontation with Hezbollah in order to forcefully disarm the group.
Right, well, let me continue the conversation. Thank you so much, Ali. I'm going to continue the conversation with Batul now. Regarding the role of the U.S. in the ceasefire and the aftermath, can you tell me, as the architect and the enforcer of this ceasefire, the Americans insisted that this time, unlike any other ceasefire, we are going to be very, very exact on and watchful for probable violations with immediate responses. But what do you think the path that they will likely take will be? Are they going to stand up to an ally, or are they going to just look the other way?
I think the path is the status quo. The guarantors of the ceasefire, you know, the US, France, they play absolutely no role. They, in the sense that they allow Israel to do whatever it wants without opposing. I mean, even worse, we saw Tom Barak, when he came to Lebanon, he said it clearly and in one word: we cannot and do not wish to pressure Israel. It's intentional. Same words of Lindsey Graham. It's that all Lebanon, all the state has to care about is disarmament, and don't even ask if Israel's going to attack or not attack after the disarmament process. So there's not even guarantees being given by America that if the disarmament occurs, that Israel will stop attacking, meaning that the occupation will resume. So, of course, these measures that you're mentioning, they mean nothing because there's been zero adherence, and actually the opposite. The US backs and justifies everything Israel does. Worse than that, what Israel does is used as a pressure. So the Israeli attacks on Lebanon is used as a pressure against Lebanon to do what Israel failed to do during the 66-day war, which is to disarm the resistance. Whilst we know that the resistance has adhered to its side of the agreement that has been, giving the weapons south of the Litani. Of course, the Lebanese state can say yes or no to the Americans who come with the demands of the Israeli entity. And your esteemed guest has made it clear that the Lebanese army has stayed committed, that it does not want to enter into this kind of a civil war. Yes, the decision to submit or to comply with American demands is therefore in the hands of the state. If the state satisfies American demands at the expense of sovereignty and independence, then that is capitulation and submission, as Tom Barak himself put it. The UN, in its previous resolutions, were not fulfilled. In this one also, do not expect it to be fulfilled. This is the reality of institutions like the UN. Whatever Israel does in serving its expansionism is completely allowed.
Right, and in about 45 seconds, please tell me, do you believe escalation is inevitable now, or can diplomacy and deterrence still prevent a war?
do believe that there is deterrence. I mean, we've reached the peak of escalation, but the resistance ultimately is preparing for the next war. This phase is about closing wars, not opening new ones, I believe. So I don't believe that we're likely to see an open war as we did in September last year. Why? Very simply, because there's no interest on either side for this to be an expanded war. Israel is at its optimum position where it can strike without receiving a direct response from the resistance. And as we know, Israel is trying to strike the existing capabilities of the resistance in a sequential manner. And the resistance is very busy rebuilding itself, closing its gaps, making uses of the lessons learnt from the war last year. And also, it is Israeli admission that the Lebanese resistance has continued, reinforcing its positions deep inside Lebanon, building its fortified sites, and expanding its military infrastructure that remains untouched by Israel's constant bombardment.
Right, thank you so much indeed, Batul, for your opinions and for your insight into the matter. I would like to once again thank Ali Rezk, security and political analyst, joining us from Beirut, and Batul Sobeiti, activist and political analyst, joining us from London. Now, a ceasefire is not a suggestion, it is a binding commitment. If Israeli violations go unanswered, then the very idea of peace becomes an illusion. To preserve credibility and justice, the world must demand accountability, because without enforcement, ceasefires are nothing more than broken promises. Thank you so much for staying with us on another Spotlight. I am Bahman Ray.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salam alaikum. This is Hussein, and you're listening to your program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about Islamic teachings and Quranic concepts pertaining to humanity and human beings. And in a couple of last episodes, we started covering a very good book in this regard, which is titled A 250-Year-Old Person, which is a combination of different lectures delivered by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, which is about the life and legacy of the great leaders of Islam, starting from the Prophet of Islam himself, Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, to the pure progeny of the Prophet, who were the role models of the leadership of the Muslim community and Ummah. So, by following the teachings and the elements, the virtues that they displayed in their life, we realize and we get closer to the Islamic ideals and Islamic standards of humanity and human beings. So we're talking about the lifestyle of the Prophet and his leadership in Medina. We talked about the Hudaybiyah Treaty. We said that in the fifth year after migration, Muslims were attacked by pagans of Mecca, the Battle of Confederate, which is a very difficult and intense situation. After that these people, I mean pagans of Mecca, could not do anything. They retreated. They came back to Mecca. A year after that, the Prophet of Islam said, okay, we go to perform pilgrimage to Mecca. And it was, for some people, it was scary because these are the people that we Actually, they came to our land last year. They intended to kill us. Only we could do a defensive strategy to save our lives. Now we want us to go there at the heart of the pagans. And the Prophet, nevertheless, started that mission, and he went to Mecca. I mean, he could not make it to Mecca. He was stopped by the pagans. Actually, pagans had the plan to kill all Muslims, or even kill the head of Muslim community like the Prophet and some of his close companions. But then with the smart plan of the Prophet, they accepted to make a deal with him, which is called Al-Hudaybiyah. And in Quran, it has been referred to as the great and manifest win, triumph. إِنَّا فَتَحْنَا لَكَ فَتْحًا مُبِينًا. We have made a great victory for you, a victory that is visible to everyone. And at that time, it was not visible for some people. They would not see that the strategic value of this. Some of the companions or some of the people who were there, they thought that this is a sign of the weakness of the Prophet, but only time showed it to everyone that it was in the benefit of the Prophet, because it allowed Islam to spread and allowed other people in the Arabian Peninsula to see the true message of Islam and to see that the Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and his message has been acknowledged by his enemies. Now, they realize that they cannot defeat him altogether, that they acknowledge him. And so after that, the next year, the seventh year of after Hijrah, the Prophet performed Umrah tul Qadha, the compensation Umrah, and people started coming to religion of Islam. They realized and they knew about it more and more. And with this, then you have the next year, which is the eighth year after Hijrah, you have the triumphant return of the Prophet to Mecca, which is after the betrayal and treason and breaching the treaty by pagans. Then the Prophet, he gathered his companion, and they went toward Mecca, and without a war, they could enter Mecca as triumphant people. And there, you could say that the problem of paganism, the challenge posed by pagans for Islam, finished. In the Fatah of Mecca, those problems were finished, because they converted to Islam with the mercy of the Prophet, actually. They were supposed to be enslaved by the triumphant army, but the Prophet forgave them all and said, "Antum uttalaqa," you are not slaves. According to the standards and the values of that time, they were supposed to be, because they were, some of them killed some of the close companions of the Prophet, his uncle. But the Prophet said, no, this is a different thing. So the story about the triumphant return to Mecca is a different story. We want to go to the next challenge of the Prophet, which were the Jewish communities. Inshallah, we're going to cover them after the break.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin al-Mustafa. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin al-Mustafa.
Welcome back. This is Hussein, and you're listening to your program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. We're talking about the challenges that the Prophet of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala had in his mission. We talked about the pagans, and now this is time to talk a little bit about the challenges that he had with minorities in Medina, including Jewish communities. Now, Jewish communities were different from pagans. First of all,
They were educated. They had access to books, and they had good businesses. They were somehow elite in terms of the education, and also elite in terms of their the financial position, because they had good businesses. So initially, there was no problem. When the Charter of Medina, the Constitution of Medina, was signed by everyone, everybody accepted, and the Prophet did not force them to convert to Islam or anything. Their religion was respected, and their possessions, everything, they were given citizenship, all the rights and privileges that a normal citizen of Medina, they had it also. But there were three groups, Bani Qaynuqa and Bani Nadir and Bani Qurayza. So each of them showed a different kind of betrayal and treason. So Bani Qaynuqa, they started a situation by killing a Muslim in the marketplace, and then there was a fight between Muslims and them, and because they breached the treaty, they had to refer to the Prophet. They did not do it, so the Prophet, and they themselves wanted to leave, and the Prophet said, okay, you can leave. And then you have Bani Nadir. They plotted to assassinate the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and they failed. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala revealed their plan to the Prophet, and then Prophet also, again, with these people, he gave them time just to pack and go, and they did it. But the greatest treason and betrayal came from Banu Qurayza. If you remember, we talked about the Battle of the Trench, which was very intense and difficult for Muslims, because the other name for it was Battle of the Confederates. All the parties, they got together, pagans of Quraysh, because they were considered to be the elite ruling of Mecca, and all people in Arabian Peninsula, they respected them. So these people gathered all other tribes to fight Muslims. So this is the biggest army coming toward Medina. And in that intense situation, when Medina is under siege, you see Banu Qurayza starting to backstab the Prophet, which is a very difficult situation. There are verses in the whole Quran about this. Inshallah, we're going to cover that in the next episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Jannah, it's all I ever wish for. This life is not eternal, but the next will last forever. We'll be right back.
100% if you believe. When truth is obfuscated, when crimes are ignored, when massacre if you deny.
Today, I want to talk about trauma. For 2 years, Palestinians have endured what the UN now officially calls genocide, an era marked by the largest cohort of child amputees in history. 70% of the infrastructure in Gaza has been reduced to rubble. There's been relentless displacement, drone attacks, bombs, snipers shooting toddlers. We all remember 5-year-old Hind Rajab, who was shot hundreds of times as she called for help. The mass graves, the execution of journalist Anas al-Sharif, and hundreds more of his colleagues, as well as health workers. Soldiers taunting starving families, babies abandoned to die in incubators. And the onslaught continues, as does the trauma. UNICEF estimates that nearly every child in Gaza, that's 1.2 million children, needs urgent mental health intervention. And for those of us watching from the outside, this genocide has been live streamed to our phones between cat memes and bikini thirst traps, none of which can be thought of as accidental in our precisely engineered algorithmic feeds. This is not just brutality. It's the calculated application of political violence and psychological warfare. Tech platforms we depend on are unambiguous about their ties to Israel. TikTok has appointed a former IDF soldier, Erica Mindell, to lead content moderation. At Meta, Guy Rosen, also former IDF, is in charge of integrity. How is Israel, with the aid of these platforms, weaponizing trauma? Are these tech spaces neutral, or have they become tools of surveillance? To help us understand how trauma functions and to reclaim agency, I'm joined by Ashira Darwij, a Palestinian trauma healer and meditation trainer, specializing in trauma shaped by political violence. Ashira has worked alongside leading figures like Dr. Gabor Mate and Dr. Kath Temple, and previously served as a journalist for the BBC. She has also worked at Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International during her years in Palestine. Ashira, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mariam. It's my pleasure.
I guess for people who aren't fully familiar with your journey, can you tell us a little bit about what took you to the work that you do today? Because you've had several phases, haven't you, in your career. So how do you end up a trauma therapist today?
I started my journey as a journalist because I was forced into it in a way. I was in Palestine. I was detained the first time when I was 16 years old. And that detention shaped and changed who I was. I wanted to be a musician. And after that detention, I was like, what musician in this world? And I couldn't unsee the detention center, the police, the system. And I decided I want to be a journalist who helps people. I don't want to be a journalist like the ones who took pictures of me when I was on the floor getting beaten up by soldiers while they were trying to break my knees. So that was the first shift. And I did journalism for years. I was taught by Allah yarhamha Shireen Abu Aqle and some amazing Palestinian teachers in Bir Zeit University who taught us from the get-go that what you learn in the books has nothing to do with the reality of what you will see on the ground. And all these things that we learn about the protection of journalists and the rights that journalists have, nothing. It doesn't exist in your world because you are black, brown, and you exist in a white supremacist colonial system. Despite that, I still tried my best to fight through the machines and to try to tell our stories. I used every platform possible. I did a reality TV show on YouTube that was aired also on American channels called Sleepless in Gaza and Jerusalem, which is still available now on YouTube, about how life was for Palestinians in all of Palestine and in Gaza. It's thinking about what we filmed then in Gaza and what is now Gaza, it's heartbreaking. And we tried in every in every modality possible. I did fixing for international journalists. I worked with BBC Media Action. I worked here in the UK with BBC London. And eventually I got to the point where I was like, this is doing nothing. Mm. And at the realm of the BBC, it was very clear that the editorial team is all very patriarchal men who are allied, support, and have very strong connections with Israel. Mm. So it's very hard to break through the system. No matter what the journalists on the ground, how amazing they are, how much they try to get the stories, there's someone on the top. The Palestinians always claim, even if it's a lawyer, even if it's a politician, we claim. And Israelis always state. The IDF states and the Palestinians claim that maybe some people died. The language that is used, everything that is used to suppress our voices and to support the Zionist entity. And then I thought, okay, maybe human rights. So I went into human rights, thinking that it's different. I worked with Human Rights Watch, with Amnesty International, and I was faced with the same. There's always opposition. During this time, of course, while working with as a journalist, while being just a normal Palestinian, I had my traumas. Hmm. And it all came to the point where I was injured in Nabi Saleh village, and I was lynched by an Israeli soldier, and my spine was severed. And I was paralyzed. And the Western system also medicinally couldn't help me. They said that you cannot fix a spine or injury, and especially after the spine has been severed 70%. And I had to look for alternatives. And the alternative of that I had, in order to heal my body, I had to heal my mind. Mm. And this began my journey in 2012 into starting the journey of healing. And from there, little by little, when I physically healed, I realized that there's so much mentally that I need to heal. And I dealt with my addictions. I uncovered everything that I was hiding and covering with all the adrenaline shocks and running as a journalist and running as a humanitarian and doing all this to also cover a lot of pain that was stuck within my system.
Mm.
And that brought me into the healing world. And through my self journey of healing, after that, I wanted to share it because I realized that there's also, in trauma, in our healing, colonization embedded in everything. The Western modality of talk therapy does not work on occupied brown, black bodies, people who have endured indigenous trauma. And I've noticed also in the Western societies that it's not helping people because the body experiences the trauma and the trauma needs to be released from the body itself.
Mm.
And this connection between spiritual and strength and our resilience, this separation that and the individualism that comes from the West is also integral into the therapy world.
Mm.
So I wanted to change that, and I wanted to offer the Palestinians some gateways which are come from us into our healing. And I started Catharsis Holistic Healing as a project, started working with former child prisoners, and then we expanded.
You talked about your detention in Israeli prison and the torture that you've experienced there. You discuss this in a film that we'll get onto in a second. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience of detention in the Israeli system, about the types of things that you experienced there, and what that can help maybe our audience understand about the ways in which the mass detention of Palestinians, including children, is part of a wider system of control?
My first detention was when I was 16, as I said. That was just in a peaceful protest, and I was dragged and beaten up. They tried to break my knees. Then I was punched into a jeep, then harassed and assaulted by the police officer. And the thing that people don't understand is most Palestinian children go through this. And I come from a very privileged background that normally not many of my family members or people from my group endure this experience. But the majority, 99% of Palestinian children, endure some form of harassment and assault by Israeli soldiers. And the detention is what brings on the rest of your life. It changes you, who you are. And the first thing it does is it removes the attachment with your parents. Because at that moment when soldiers are able to take you away from your family, you realize that your family can't help you. And this detachment is very important. For the rest of your life, you're trying to repair the damage that has been done. And what this means also on a political level, I wasn't very politicized. I come from a home that's very politicized, and I wanted to go into music as a way of rejecting. But I knew what was going on, but I wasn't really willing to take an active part until I was detained. And I was like, oh, okay, so this is very personal. And I think what Israel does intentionally is when you take these children, separate them, is it creates a society that's also very much ready to resist and to fight. And they want that. They want us to fight, and they want us to fight while mentally we're not stable. So on a fight, flight, fawn modality, where we're just running and trying to do whatever we can to resist. What I would say about my experience is nothing, because I experienced very, very few days in detention, very few moments of what I talk about it in Where the Olive Trees Weep, about the torture in my second arrest.
It's not a small thing.
I know, but this is part of like the Palestinian, like it is big, but in comparison to what my sisters have gone through. And my brothers.
So tell us about that story in context then of what others of people are going through, because you're taken into a shower at a certain point thinking that you're being helped, as it were, because you were having your period at that time, but then the shower turns out to not be a shower.
Yeah, I was basically put in a room where it's hot water and cold water and you can't get out. It's like a coffin and there's nowhere to go. And you're just experiencing whatever. It's that loss of control completely. And the feeling of being also claustrophobic doesn't help. And this is one of the things that I witnessed. I was taken to the rooms where they have the electricity, and I was trapped to a chair where there's to be electrocuted, but I wasn't electrocuted. I was just threatened by it. And I saw blood in that room on every single corner. It's like a very white room where you have like blood splits. And listening to the stories of the people who were next to me in the detention, it was just one horror story after the other. And then working with the women prisoners afterwards, sexual harassment, beatings, a lack of sleep. You never know night from day. You don't know. They intentionally try to make sure that you don't sleep at all. So you're sleep deprived. There's no food. And then there's so many different processes. Sometimes they put you in rooms with the informants who speak Arabic to try to get information from you. And there's physical and emotional torture that has been orchestrated. Like somebody, some sick Israeli was sitting and preparing what methods they're going to use. And they tailor them based on what people. One of my friends sat for 30 days in the interrogation, didn't know any day or light, didn't know who was the interrogators, because they made it. She never went to an actual interrogation room, but she was interrogated the whole time. And she lost part of, like, because of the paranoia, she couldn't recognize what's right and what's wrong. And she dissociated from her whole life. Wow. She didn't recognize her life when she came out, because everything was mixed between the reality and the illusion. So they orchestrate ways. This is other than the physical torture. The stories that we hear now about raping, about using the bottle to rape Palestinian prisoners has been used for years.
I remember hearing about it back when I was there in 2005, it being used, bottles to rape children.
This has been used. Palestinian women have been raped. Listen to the stories of Rasmiya Odeh, and listen to how the Americans kicked her out of the U.S. because of Israeli pressure. Israel is a master of torture. And they just use different ways to torture people. Palestinian kids that I worked with, the worst one, was also house arrest. I was also put in house arrest. And I was put only for one time for 29 days, one time for 15. It breaks the attachment with your parents even further. I hated my mother. She became my jailer. I was like, Mama, I just want to go to the balcony. Like, I'm old. I was 25 or something like that. And she wouldn't let me get on the balcony. And I was like...
Because she was worried about you.
She was worried because they make your parents also sign that they will pay thousands of dollars if you get out. And then they tell them that we will re-arrest them. So your parent becomes the jailer. And I've seen children who are 9 and 8. And I had to, like, take care of, like, go interview them and talk to them in their houses. And they expressed the same thing. They're like, take us back to jail. At least we're with other prisoners. We know that we're in jail. But I can't stand my mother and my father being the person who does this to me.
You've worked also with some of the children who've come out from Gaza. In fact, you and I both visited some of those children and their families just last year, actually. And I know you've continued working with them. A 2021 Euromed report had shown that 91% of children in Gaza suffered from PTSD as a result of Israeli military attacks. And that was more than 2 years, of course, before the genocide began. A more recent report found that 96% of children feel that their death is imminent. And that might not be just a feeling, sadly. Nearly half say they want to die, which is just, I can't even get my head around that statistic. You've spent considerable time working with these children. What do you observe about the trauma that they've experienced?
I think what people need to understand is the trauma that has happened since the past 2 years, not only to the people in Gaza, to the entire world, is nothing that we have experienced in our lifetimes. It's nothing in comparison to the genocides before, because this is televised. This is on your phone. This is in your home while you're eating. Of course the children in Gaza are going to say they want to die. If I was there, I would want to die too. Why would you want to be in a place that's constantly bombed, where you lose your entire family and you see people you love getting burned alive and the whole world is watching it happen and you're starved to death and you have nowhere safe to go? Of course you'd rather be dead. Yani, there's no logic in wanting to be alive in a place like Gaza. The people who are there, who are still trying to find ways of hope and sing, and these people are angels. They're not normal. There's nothing normal about being in a situation like a genocide and wanting to stay alive. Mm-hmm. And one of the women that we met said she wants to, if we want to help her, we would help her how to kill herself in a way that's Islamically appropriate. She wanted to die. She had one child and she blamed the child for her having to stay alive.
You know, I think people who may be new to the conflict, to the occupation, may not be aware of the extent to which Israel has used psychological warfare against Palestinians for decades throughout the entire occupation. And so when I'm observing certain tactics on the ground, whether that is the continuous displacement, whether that is the airdropping of aid when there are multiple entry points, you know, including by sea, into Gaza, you don't need to drop it by air, or when I observe the food points where people have to walk for miles and then get shot at to get food, like, I think to myself, these things are engineered. These things are by design. And if they are by design, what is the psychological objective of these strategies? Why are the Israelis using these tactics beyond obviously making food itself an act of life and death?
They are engineered completely. They're very smart in torture, and they know exactly how to dehumanize us. Also, having these people running very poor, impoverished, the look of people while they reach to the food centers is already dehumanized to the West. The way they see us, these men running, and the Hunger Games, in a way, the way that they play with us and they taunt us is very much engineered for the West. So also, it activates adrenaline in people who are watching. There's a part that is trying to push people to want to consume it also. They want to